Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripajczyk. On today's show, we'll hear from two teachers from the Caucus of Rank and File Educators to discuss recent controversies and issues involving Chicago public schools. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, we'll hear two reports about news of media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Now that the $7.2 billion broadband stimulus package has been passed by Congress, it's up to government agencies to fund projects that will bring high-speed internet and data services to unserved and underserved areas. One of the first tasks is to figure out where broadband is available. The stimulus package includes $350 million for broadband mapping. Public interest groups want the mapping process to be conducted by a government agency, but industry lobbyists are aggressively pushing to privatize the mapping process. Art Brodsky of Public Knowledge says that would give the phone and cable companies too much power.
And those companies have it within their power to decide which data gets reported, how it gets reported, who can see it and who can't see it. Their modus operandi up until now has been to sign very restrictive non-disclosure agreements with states and basically take control of the mapping process. And what we see is a conflict of interest of basically privatizing the mapping function.
Public Knowledge, Common Cause, the Media and Democracy Coalition, and Reclaim the Media issued a report last week called Privatizing the Public Trust. It criticizes the most well-known mapping organization, Connected Nation, which is funded by telephone and cable companies. Connected Nation's maps don't differentiate between broadband service types like DSL, cable, or fiber, and all the data collected remains the property of AT&T. But despite these substantial flaws, Connected Nation is getting a lot of attention from policymakers.
The problem is that in many states, Connected Nation or like affiliates are totally wired in, if you forgive the expression, to the process, basically through their patrons and the phone and cable companies. In Minnesota, for example, the legislature directly appropriated money to them to do mapping, going around every established other group in the state.
Brodsky is concerned that Connected Nation's deep corporate ties will influence the federal mapping process, as it has in some states.
It's incumbent upon activists to be on the lookout for these kind of awards, for these kind of proceedings, and intervene. Having companies take control of the data for their own advantage so that it's not transparent to the public, it's not verifiable, it's not granular, it's not accurate, it's not accountable, is a bad way to go and a terrible waste of money, and we're trying to prevent that.
Say the word Madagascar, and most Americans will think of the animated movie about cute zoo animals. But the actual island nation of Madagascar, off the African coast, has been in turmoil. A power struggle has resulted in the ouster of the country's president. More than 160 people have been killed this year, and protests are escalating. But there's been little news of the situation in the mainstream U.S. media. Luva Rakotomalala, a native of Madagascar, is a research associate at Purdue University. He's been blogging at globalvoicesonline.org for a couple of years. He noticed an uptick in messages on Twitter, the social networking site, from people in Madagascar last month when the violence increased. Twitter limits messages to 140 characters, which makes it perfect for transmitting small bits of information by cell phone. Rakotomalala quickly realized the potential of this new technology to distribute news from his homeland. He says that Twitter was appealing because it's quick, it can be sent with a phone, and it's mobile.
One of the problems, I think, was that the local journalists were all located in one location. Usually it's downtown of the capital city, and a lot of the unrest and turmoil were in different regions, and there was no way they could really get any real information about what was going on over there. So it was important, I think, that if someone was there, that they could rapidly send some information via cell phone, and then we would put it on Twitter, and then we could see where he is, and then they would verify if someone else is there, and then we would have a more accurate picture of how much turmoil is really going on.
Rakotomalala creates blog posts from the Twitter messages. The accounts, which include pictures and videos, have caught the attention of the Wall Street Journal, the BBC, and Al Jazeera. But Rakotomalala is quick to point out that neither he nor the members of the Twittering group are journalists. They're simply concerned about what's happening in Madagascar and want to get the word out.
Global Voices helped us with an outreach program. They helped us start a project that would help people who are not very familiar with new media start blogging and start Twittering.
There is concern for the safety of the members of the group, particularly since a journalist in Madagascar was killed in February. Some Twitterers have been intimidated at gunpoint and told to delete photos from their cameras, but they're still out there gathering information.
It is a concern, but the only thing we can do is advise them to stay away from where the violence is really taking place and just try to report from far.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net. Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. 2 weeks ago, Media Minutes reported that Time Warner Cable planned to introduce a new tiered broadband pricing scheme that would have forced consumers to pay up to $150 a month for full access to the internet. Four markets were targeted for the experiment, two in Texas, one in New York, and one in North Carolina. On April 16th, the cable giant backed down. Free Press campaign director Timothy Carr says the plan was met with an intense negative reaction from the grassroots that reverberated through the halls of Congress.
It sparked local outrage. It really started at the consumer level. You had a group like StopTheCap.com, which was formed by a few Time Warner Cable users based in Rochester who put up a website, started posting videos and blogs there about the growing consumer protest. And this soon caught the attention of other groups like ours, Free Press. We went out and started to ask our 500,000 activists to raise their voice in protest and call on Congress to investigate this Time Warner scheme. And then members of Congress, beginning with Eric Massa, who represents a lot of the people in Rochester, New York, wrote a letter demanding a full explanation and has proposed legislation which would stop this sort of metering. And it was really a multi-pronged collaboration that created this snowball effect that landed firmly on the executives at Time Warner Cable. They ultimately capitulated when Senator Schumer of New York flew up to Rochester to have a meeting with some of the activists and some of the Time Warner Cable execs. And that was really the straw that broke the camel's back in this case. And we saw a very powerful corporation that had sought to become a gatekeeper to our internet experience buckle under the pressure of public organizing and activism.
Carr says consumers may have won this battle against predatory practices by cable internet providers, but Time Warner Cable isn't going away anytime soon.
They see their traditional market for cable television as under threat, and it's under threat directly from a free and open internet. Other internet providers, including Comcast and AT&T, you know, all of the largest high-speed internet providers in the country, are still considering new ways that they can profit more heavily from internet use.
For more information about the fight against Time Warner Cable, go to StopTheCaps.com.
The Women's Media Equity Collaborative is a new initiative that aims to create a network of communication across the more than 350 organizations that teach, produce, distribute, or advocate for women's media in print, on the radio, in video, and in blogs. Ariel Doherty is the co-founder of Women Make Movies and the national project director of the collaborative.
This field of women's media organizations and outlets has actually never had a forum of its own to meet and strategize and talk about what its problems are. And given 20-plus years of backlash in the mainstream community against women's issues, this community of women's media is severely underfunded, misunderstood for its nature and what its purpose is. And I really feel very strongly that there is no way in which women's issues and the women's movement can advance forward without a very strong media arm.
The first major undertaking of the collaborative was to create a searchable database of women's media organizations. Susan Feiner, a feminist economist and a professor at the University of Southern Maine, is a principal investigator of the project. Feiner has tasked her students in her Women, Knowledge, and Power class to find the organizations, collect more information, and organize the data. Feiner says that one of the major goals of the collaborative is to establish a model of sustainable funding. They'll discuss their findings, among many other issues, at a summit on July 16th at the Allied Media Conference in Detroit.
One of the goals of the summit is to discuss our funding needs collaboratively. Right now, many, many, many of these organizations are just every couple of months on the brink of a financial disaster. And they have to spend so much time and energy writing grants and doing fundraising that the fundraising crowds out the media work that they're trying to do.
For more information about the Women's Media Equity Collaborative, go to mediaequity.net. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
U.S. President Barack Obama says the next move is up to Cuba to improve relations between the two countries. This statement is both typically Obama and vintage American imperialist. Obama, just like his American presidential predecessors stretching back more than two centuries, thinks the United States has the right to decide when it's time for other countries to forgive America's own crimes, even when the Americans continue to commit those crimes. Obama tried to run that game at the Summit of the Americas in Trinidad this weekend, when he spoke of setting aside stale debates and old ideologies. That's the same language he uses here in the U.S. when people want to talk seriously about curbing the power of money or creating a single-payer healthcare system. Obama pretends that everything he says is fresh rather than stale, even when it's old as dirt or stolen from somebody else. He claims to have no ideology while practicing imperialism, backed up by the biggest military budget in history, 24 hours a day. Since Obama smiles when he utters this kind of nonsense, he is called a statesman and a cool dude. But let's return to Cuba and the next move. President Obama has made concessions mostly to Cuban exile families who'd like to visit their relatives and send more money more often. Obama has not undone the historic U.S. economic, political, diplomatic, and cultural blockade of Cuba, but only some of George Bush's more egregious barriers, and mostly for the benefit of Cuban Americans. Cuban leader Raul Castro has offered to put everything on the table for discussion, including exchanges of political prisoners. That's a much bigger concession for Cuba than for the United States. Cuba holds scores of prisoners that Havana says have sought to undermine the state and serve the interests of foreigners, meaning the Americans. The United States holds only the Cuban Five, Cubans sent to infiltrate exile groups in Florida that were breaking the laws of the United States by carrying out operations against Cuba. Although convicted of espionage, the Cuban Five were not spying on the United States, but instead spying on right-wing Cubans in the United States. In other words, the Cuban prisoners the U.S. holds pose no threat to the U.S., while the prisoners Havana holds may well pose a threat to Cuba. It is Cuba that would give up the most in an exchange. Yet Obama plays it coy and non-committal, while claiming that ideology and the preservation of the imperial big stick have nothing to do with it. Raul Castro and Hugo Chavez are the bigger men in this story. Raul would be perfectly justified in demanding that the United States first clear out of Guantanamo Bay, sovereign Cuban territory, before any further talks could be held on contact between relatives in Cuba and Miami, or on political prisoners. Raul could ask, on behalf of his brother, for an apology for the innumerable U.S. attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro. Venezuelan President Chavez could demand the same thing on behalf of himself for George Bush's 2002 attempted coup against his government, in which Chavez came very close to being killed. But Fidel and Chavez ask only for relations on the basis of equality. Unfortunately, equality among nations is a pill no imperialist will swallow, including Barack Obama. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature a presentation by two teachers from the Caucus of Rank and File Educators to discuss recent controversies and issues involving Chicago public schools. The two teachers, Jim and Susan, spoke at a panel discussion and film screening organized by the Albany Park North Park Mayfair Neighbors for Peace and Justice, held in Chicago on Saturday, March 28, 2009.
Okay. Well, you saw the film, so this whole plan has been going on for the past 5 or 6 years, and it seems to be steamrolling. And really, in context, it's right with the economic situation in the country. You have a neoconservative, neoliberal agenda for big business to make all the decisions, to not have regulations, and as a result, you see the crisis our economy is in right now. Well, that's the same thing with the schools. They came in and said, we're going to run them, the businesses are going to run them, we're going to privatize them. And what does that mean? That means less regulations. And in public schools, when you have less regulations, because they don't want bureaucracy, they keep talking about regulations are not good, we don't need bureaucracy. As a result, you've got kids who are not getting their special education services, kids who are not getting their ELL, the ESL services, English. They're getting around a lot of stuff. We've seen a lot of corruption. We see the school right down the street here, Aspira, that is a very shady past. It's who they are. These are people who have connections to the mayor, they have connections to businesses. They're the ones that are getting the contracts. Kids are losing. And a perfect example, they're going in the context of school choice. They want better schools, and they keep putting out that the schools are failing. And the whole thing, it started when Paul Vallis started running the schools back in the mid-90s, late-90s, was all of a sudden it became fashionable, the teacher bash. It's the teacher's fault. And of course, as you know, living in the inner city, you have a lot of social problems. You've got kids that, have violence in their homes. You know, they don't even have, enough food to eat and stuff. And they're bringing these problems into the schools. So the schools are doing more than just teaching, more than just the books. And they're saying, well, it's your fault that they're not scoring the same criteria what kids in the suburbs or kids that come from stable backgrounds. And that's the whole standardized testing thing. So it's really this whole business model that's put on here, and it's just uprooting communities. It's making people really upset. They're also, as far as any civil rights issue, I talked to aldermen and say, look, they're reversing the civil rights stuff. For example, many black teachers have lost their jobs because they're forcing out veteran teachers. They're saying you can't teach because of this test. And also, these new Renaissance schools don't have to fit the don't have to follow the desegregation decrees. So, that was whole Board versus Brown of Education. Now they get around that. So all these new teachers right out of school, they come in there and they can't handle the situations, but they get it off the books. They're not under the microscope like public schools are. People are making money, so there's a lot of questions here going on, and one of the important things to remember is that these people are making decisions about the schools now are the same people who are foreclosing on people's homes, the same people, everybody losing their jobs and stuff. So we wanted it to stop, and the thing that we did, enough of us in the Chicago Teachers Union were so upset, we said we want to band together and bring everybody together and protest in unison, because and it's exactly what Daley doesn't want to happen, and that's what we're trying to form now, an organized resistance. And as a result of that organized resistance, they took 6 schools off the closing list. So they hear it, they're still trying to, work their own plan and get around that, a lot of loopholes, a lot of lying and stuff, but we're still coming out, and we're really saying that we really need all the communities to understand this and to, protest, all of us to come together united to stop this and people to see what's really happening.
Could you mention briefly the SOTO bill?
Yeah, right now in the legislative front, there is Representative Cynthia Soto on the north side. She's has a few schools that are closed in her area. One was Carpenter School. They came to her and they said, can you do something? And she has sponsored a bill in the House that is going to put a moratorium on all school closings. It's going to stop it. It's supposed to reverse all the school closings that happened this year. And it got out of the Education Committee, I think. It's about to pass. I think it's got enough support to pass the House and then go to the Senate. And it would have to go through the process in the Senate, and then the governor would have to sign it. Now, it's a facilities bill, so it looks at the buildings, but it looks at the whole process of how are they all of a sudden closing schools. It's like a done deal that's hatched from top, and then they tell the communities that, we're sorry your school's closed, and this is what's going to happen. And they're saying, we need the community involvement to say, as stakeholders, to listen to parents, teachers, local school councils, to get their input. So anybody who would, you know, who agrees with the in opposition to Renaissance 2010 plan should find out who your state representative is and state senator and give them a call and just say that you're opposed, you're supportive of the Soto bill that would put a moratorium until more research and input from communities happen. So that's one good thing on the state level. And state law trumps the local level. And the reason the Renaissance 2010 plan is happening now is because Mayor Daley has total control of the schools. So when we talk to aldermen, and the aldermen should be at the forefront of this because of the community's protest. In the last board meeting, there were six buses that went down to protest. Five of them were turned away because they said they didn't have enough capacity. They were all upset that they're closing their schools and they're putting in these new charter schools and other different types of schools into the buildings. And they're trying to stop that. And the aldermen are all pretty much under Daley supporting this plan. So it really needs to, you know, the people have to more and more rise up, and that's what we're hoping, you know.
Jim covered a lot of things I wanted to talk about. The whole, I don't remember who spoke about it in the video, but the invalid comparison between public and charter is one of the hugest things, because they set our schools up to fail, and then they give them more resources, they give them all these things, and then they say, well, why aren't you doing as well as these schools? And they don't actually score any higher than the public schools, is what we're finding out now, which is hysterical because they say how great they are, but they're not actually scoring any higher. Charter schools only have to have 50% certified teachers, so they have new teachers coming in all the time that aren't certified. They last 2 years, they get burnt out, they're gone, so they get to keep the salaries nice and low, and then nobody ever gets good at teaching. So right now, they're able to say that the charters are performing, but I think in a couple of years, we're going to see their scores are going to be way worse than ours are, because they don't actually have professional teachers doing it. My school's being closed this year. We were on the list last year, and it's a direct result of CPS sabotaging us. We were a small middle school in Pilsen, 100% Hispanic students, 100% low-income students. They cut our buses off, so there were no kids coming from outside of the immediate area anymore, and a lot of our kids came from there. They opened an UNO charter school down the block, and then they came after us saying that we were under-enrolled. And so just a couple weeks ago, we got a notice saying that we were a state, I don't remember, award-winning school. The state of Illinois gave us an award that only 500 schools in the state got, because we were doing such a great job with low-income minority students, and now we're closed. Wow. So they just keep sabotaging us. The other part of the sabotage is the hearing process that the board uses to close the schools. Last year, when my school was on the chopping block, they said, go downtown February 14th, you have this hearing, it's 6 to 8 p.m., and this is your chance to speak. And so we brought a bus full of kids, the principal, a bunch of teachers, we all spoke, and then we found out after the fact that nobody from the board actually read our testimony. Mm. Every child in the school wrote a letter to the board, and it was never read. So this year, one of the things that CORE was doing was organizing and making sure that we had people at every single one of the hearings to let these schools know that nobody was going to listen to them, and also to document what was happening, because nobody actually documents it from the board. So if you go to our website, there's a link where we documented every single word that was said at these public hearings, which wasn't listened to by the Board of Ed. And
surprise, surprise.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. We knew it was going to happen. The six schools that were saved, Huberman came in and said it was because they made compelling testimony. But looking back on our notes, one of the schools that was on that list didn't send anybody to their hearing. They sent like two people. So there were schools that sent hundreds of people to go testify and talk about their great programs. They didn't get saved, but the school that didn't send any representation was saved because of their testimony that was so compelling, even though there was no testimony. So that just tells us.
Which school was that?
That was...
Not Hamilton, was it?
No, no, no.
Hamilton. I thought it was the two schools that were up there.
Which one was it? That they said had a lot of testimony, but didn't.
Oh, that's okay if you can't
remember.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
I don't remember which one it was. But if you look at our schools, you'll see which one didn't have anybody. Yeah, it's just heartbreaking. And them locking us out of the board meetings and stuff. And teachers, we only have 3 personal business days. I burned all of mine going to, I went to the board meeting in December and spoke. I went in February and spoke. And I'm out of personal business days. So they're going unwatched also. So these schools that came out and got rejected this last time, now they're just shutting them out. It's just, there's so many layers of craziness going on. And the last thing, just the other sabotage thing that I forgot to write down, one of our speakers talked about how schools didn't have teachers for 6 weeks. This is the new thing that they're doing, and it's affecting us right now because CPS puts out their positions for the following year last week or the week before. So schools are finding out how many positions are being cut in their schools. Like Hyde Park had, what, 15 positions cut for next year? It's projected based on what they think is going to happen next year. But what she was talking about is they make these projections, and then they close down the neighborhood schools, they get an influx of students, and then we have classes with 50 kids in an algebra class and no teacher. There's no teacher, so they put them 50 to a class. And then they blame us for our scores going down. And it's just a big, vicious circle.
As part of the question and answer session, I asked the following question.
I guess this might be a little bit of a quasi-question and also a little bit of an observation. It actually touches on the presentation that Albany Park actually had some months ago. The parallels with this, I'm reminded of the presentation that we had about the company formerly known as Blackwater. The company actually, as a PR move, changed their name to Z, spelled X-E. But they're not Blackwater anymore, and that's going to fix everything, of course. But the reason I mentioned this is that companies like Blackwater and Triple Canopy and DynCorp, who are kind of these militaries for hire, or mercenary firms that are trying to basically do the kind of privatization of what previously had been a public institution, the military, and they're serving that capacity. It's now under a fair amount of critical scrutiny, mainly because, certainly involved with Blackwater, there's been a lot of calamities. The famous raid in 2004 in Fallujah, where 4 people who were Americans were killed. Those four men were actually Blackwater employees. In late 2007, you had, I think, 17 Iraqis who were killed in the dramatic raid straight out by Blackwater personnel. The reason I mention this is because you've got this. These kinds of things kind of get attention, I think, only when calamity strike. And the reason I mention this whole thing and drawing it to a comparison with public schools and the increasing privatization and removal from a kind of more public and accountable structure is that I'm afraid that we might see some kind of, this thing might come to wider attention if a calamity should strike. And God forbid anything like that should happen, but I'm just afraid. I'm sorry? Well, I mean, you're right. I'm not to say that what's happening now isn't calamitous, but that's not the kind of humongous, dramatic thing that's gonna bound to get cameras and headlines, and that's what I'm talking about. I mean, you're right. It's like what's been going on regarding Renaissance 2010 and the entire film. This has been going on for years, and it's all a calamity. But it's not that kind of the big, dramatic thing that's gonna probably get the attention of the major corporate media. I'm afraid, and this is what I'd like to have people talk about, is that it could be the kind of situation where we're laying the groundwork for one or who knows how many calamities of any form might happen, and then this will get attention, but then it might be too late. What do you think?
There was a teacher from Clemente that commented on it, and that's one of our fears, is that there's going to be a gang war in the middle of one of these high schools, because you keep shutting down these schools, and these kids are being forced into one school with 3, 4, 5 different gangs in the one school. And that's where most of the violence is coming from. I know Clemente's problem started when they started moving kids in.
Yeah, and after they closed Austin.
and when they closed Austin.
Right.
And this year they're going to close Fanger. Where are those kids going to go?
Then on the south side, Fanger?
Yeah. They're going to go Julian, Robeson, and then there's going to be a gang war in one of these schools. That's.
So if I. Did you want to? If you.
Well, just one thing. The when they talked about, they made a lot of charter schools in New Orleans, and that was brought on by the Katrina catastrophe. It's like, if anybody's familiar, there's a book written called Shock Doctrine, where they'll use a big crisis to then implement quickly their, you know, privatization thing that's very unpopular with people, but they can use that to quickly get it in. So that's kind of like an opposite effect.
Right, right.
I would like to comment on that. One of the purposes of this meeting and other meetings that have been taking place around the city and organizing is to get this issue more widely known and organized, to organize against this Renaissance 2010 more than it has been. There has been some corporate media attention so far. When Aspira did the illegal strip search of the students, it got into the front page of the Sun-Times. The various demonstrations downtown, the booing of Huberman when he was introduced as the new chief, the CEO, this got into the front page of the Tribune, it got onto the TV stations, but to have a continual campaign to build up opposition on these things is what's needed. So one of the purposes of this meeting is to educate people, to encourage people to get organized, so that we can have further campaigns, either on locally on this issue of the privatized Aspira Hagen School, and then more broadly in the city and in the country. So, and that is to try to prevent some of these catastrophes happening.
My God, yes, I hope so.
And there are other struggles going on that we haven't mentioned yet that need attention as the Renaissance process continues. So an answer to your question is not to wait until something happens and then people will wake up, but to do the organizing now, and there are daily catastrophes, and to prevent more of them.
That was the voice of an Albany Park activist, Neil Reznikoff, speaking at a panel on March 28, 2009. To learn more about the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, go online to www.coreteachers.org. Core Teachers is spelled CoreTeachers. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.